I'm Christopher Lighton with the Haitian-American painter and poet Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell. She writes of the January earthquake that the sky, it seemed, let go of the Christ statue that had looked over her childhood. God let go of his son's hand as the roofs of Port-au-Prince collapsed on her city. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is the third in a group of conversations with poets, word artists, about a catastrophe beyond words. Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell is a visual artist, too, celebrated for her brilliant panoramas of Haiti's street life, its voodoo temples, its spirit life. And then, in a spooky coincidence, on the very day of the earthquake, January 12th, she got the news that her book of Haiti stories, titled Company of Heaven, had won the University of Iowa Award for Short Fiction. So we're listening here in the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square to an artist in prose, paint, and poetry. For her, the Haiti earthquake smashed a large landscape of memory and imagination. So your characters, your people, your places have all been transformed and injured and changed in deep ways, Marilyn. Did you know people who died in the quake?
Of course. No one in Port-au-Prince remains unaffected. We've all lost people. And to that question, I feel like answering, I've lost 240,000 brothers and sisters. You know, we're all affected by what happens to the community. We're all connected. There are horror stories of people buried alive and having their cell phones and speaking to their family or their loved ones as they're suffocating until you don't hear them anymore. If life is a rite of passage, this is really a terrible rite at the end of this initiatory death, in a sense. And I had a dear friend in particular, a priest, actually, a holy man, Father Lespinasse, who died in the seminary. He was preparing for his class and in his room and caught there. But this is a man who had come from an upper class, and when he inherited the family mansion, he transformed into an orphanage, which he ran. And asking about him recently to a common friend, I found out that his assistant went every day with a sheet and a rope to wait and see when he would be found so she could perhaps, you know, pull him out. But he was not found in time. You were asking about the stories. The collection is called The Company of Heaven, and these are all stories of a family, of a people, and of places that are destroyed or forever altered. But in particular, one story in there called River Valley Rooms is pointedly more about my family home and how it was transformed into apartments and things. And so it speaks of lives that have crossed to it and how the walls themselves carry the memory. It's been eerie for me this past couple of weeks to do the copy editing and having to reread these stories. Doing this copy editing and rereading the stories, I realized that not only do we invest in people so much of our sense of self, but that we invest also a lot in buildings. We expect them to remember and to pass on who we are. I mean, my childhood is obviously long gone, but it isn't until all of it crumbled to nothing that I realized how I expected these walls to remember and pass on something. We imprint people with our presence and our passage in each other's lives, but we imprint objects and things.
Marilyn, within days of the earthquake, you were writing about it. And I take it you keep working on that poem. I'd love to hear it in its form today.
I was a child always gazing at the sky. Each time we drove past the Church of the Sacred Heart of Jesus in Port-au-Prince, my eyes met with Christ. I never missed the chance, as we passed the church, to look up, contemplate the immense robed Christ who stood on top of the steeple, a seemingly weightless statue lifted on the cloudless sky, graceful and white against the blue, blue, forever blue vastness, there for all time, arms open wide, extended like branches of a great tree on which we would all rest. Yet, on January 12th, the Port-au-Prince sky let go of its Christ. God the Father let go of his Son's hands and let him take the fall. The roof of All Saints, who long ago had watched over my first communion vows at the Sacred Heart, collapsed over the whole city. The roofs over All Saints watching over the whole city collapsed onto us all. The roof over the cathedral with the stained glass angels collapsed onto the archbishop. The roof of St. Anne's Church collapsed onto maimed and crippled creatures who congregated at the entrance to beg for alms. The ceiling of the Church of St. Trinity collapsed onto empty pews, but took down with it the brilliant mural of the Nativity and the Company of Heaven. Gone the angels, gone the colors, silent the trumpeters. All hearts bleed as one heart. The roofs of all of Port-au-Prince collapsed. They collapsed onto the people they sheltered. They buckled, contorted, cracked, sagged, crumpled, slumped, and caved in. Limbs of churches lie among limbs of people, dried, splintery, brittle, and oddly disassembled, like the limbs of a crustacean carelessly crushed under a human foot. People, severed and suffocated, lie among collapsed statues of martyrs and angels without wings. Under the sun that pulls all moisture from parched bodies trapped alive under rubble, a white dust covers the city. Legless, armless, all manner of self-maimed beggars who daily assemble on all sidewalks of the city and compete for alms at the crossroads where cars stop at the red lights. All the self-mutilated beings sitting on the remaining stumps they spared themselves. All the crippled are left whole and untouched. There are no roofs to fall on them in the marginal carbon monoxide poisoned sidewalk regions where they have lived, scuttering like insects. People think these beggars suffered from an act of God. They did not. They amputated themselves to become visible to the world. They believed the human condition is the act of God. All the while, they were crawling along streets called Rue Bonnefoy and Rue des Miracles, Good Faith and Miracles streets. Streets that have now crumpled 6 feet high under the exacting pressure of an unbounded earth and look like fossilized accordions of ancient tar. The beggars watch with bloodshot eyes, walls of the netherworld of unreachable wealth collapsed around them. Their mutilated flesh understanding that hell has only now arrived. All the buried and the detained, walled in graves and prison cells, ghosts and gangsters are set loose, while free men are walled in under ruins, ruins where now echo the voiceless screams of a giant animal jaw. The dead at the cemetery are not indifferent to being disinterred. My grandmother's soul sits pensively on the toothless rubble of the family tomb and watches her husband's bones exposed under the sun. The dead and the crippled are both endowed with odd vision. They shudder as they see a formless black cloud, like a flock of distant birds, quiver and float over the disemboweled city. They know it is the restless souls of countless people buried alive at the crossroads during black magic ceremonies, who have now been stirred out of improper graves by an uncanny hunger. They are searching to learn the fate of those who murdered them. They want to serve as witness as they watch them die a similar death, suffocating under the rubble of voodoo temples. The dead and the crippled tremble when they perceive, at the margin of this woeful cloud, like lace of a more delicate nature, vacillating and unsure, souls of stolen babies, bled and crushed in sacrificial ritual offerings. It is a free-for-all in this stricken land where only the laughter of orphans flown out in cargo planes may rest on clouds and resonate in heaven. And me, childless mother of dreams, I pray, because my prayers were given voice long ago. Prayer is here. It has come for us. I pray for my mother because it is through our own flesh that we perceive, feel, and understand the world. For all the error of her ways, she is still my land and the warmth I yearn for. I remember her red lips, her mirrors, her bare breast, and I pray that she is not crushed under the collapse of her roof, her dear, brittle bones cracked and piercing her like self-inflicted daggers, entombed with her dogs like a pharaoh with his servants. So I gaze at the white Cambridge sky. Looking up, I beseech him and say, please, God, do not punish her for her vanities, greed, and folly. You made her imperfect. Dear God, forgive all.
Marilyn, you know Haiti so well and in so many dimensions, having grown up there. Are there other pieces of Haitian literature that you want to invoke here, or other writers or other artists?
I left Haiti at early adolescence, I was 10 and a half, 11, because there had been a massacre in my family during the Duvalier era. The poetry in me, the feeling I have for Haiti, was more the years prior to my leaving for France. But also those were years where, you know, I was not yet educated in literature and all of that. So the literature I was educated in, the sensibility of an adolescence, I was French literature. So I grew up with Verlaine, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, you know, Racine, and all of that. It is more out of as an adult that I went back to reading Haitian literature and poetry. But then it was also with the experience of being an exiled. So now you can find literature of exile, of Haitians, but at the time when I read, it was not. It was mainly men's writing, men very involved with their sensuality and protest over this or that. So let us say that I found more resonance as to who I was in, American poetry, and also Caribbean poetry. Derek Walcott is an amazing poet, and he speaks of issues that are close to mine, issues of identity, also of being a Caribbean. What is it to be a Caribbean? You're never white enough or black enough, or depending where you are, you always rejected. In the Schooner Flight, Derek Walcott wrote, I am Dutch, nigger, and English. Either I'm nobody or I am a nation. So there's this issue of who are you when you are a mix. And so I have found perhaps more identification or more resonance for me to use in the poetry of Walcott, perhaps, and Neruda, who spoke of the sacred duty of the poet to have to leave in order to return. And now you can speak of this leaving in terms of the physical nature. You have to leave your place of birth in order to return. But you can also take your place of birth is also the void out of which we are born. I have found great resonance also in Islamic poetry, in Hafiz, Rumi, and Nefari also. But I've also found, resonance in people who've come from an island. Well, not only Walcott, but John Donne also being English, and also this amazing poetry. So I have found here and there a lot of poetry that has helped me and nurtured me. Of course, you never know what influences you.
Marilyn Phipps, out of that vast range of poetry you grew up with, give us two or maybe three little samples of the places you go after the earthquake.
Well, I'll start with Donne. It's just a passage of a poem. And the poem is a hymn to Christ as the author's last going into Germany.
But this is John Donne of No Man is an Island, too.
That's right. Anyway, this is a stanza of the poem. I sacrifice this island unto thee and all whom I loved there and who loved me. When I have put our seas twixt them and me, put thou thy sea betwixt my sins and thee. As the tree's sap doth seek the root below, in winter, in my winter now I go, where none but thee, the eternal root of true love, I may know.
Thank you. Thank you, John Donne.
Now, as an answer perhaps to all and the questions you've asked me and those you haven't and will not ask me, this is from Rumi, the poet Rumi. It's Ode 2721 called Divan. For the fire within us, there is no translator. For the secret in our hearts, there is no language. For our pain, there is no intimate sigh. For our sigh, no one to share the breath. No gem emerges from the sea. There is no sea at calm. Words give birth to no meaning. Words are void of affirmation. Language is a tunnel for thought. How can an ocean flow through a tunnel? Every atom of our soul is a universe. No mouth may contain the universe.
Round this out, Marilyn, if you will, with a poem of your own, or two, or three.
I'll just give you two, because I'll give you one I like very much. And then there's one which is lovely, because it speaks of the beauty of Haiti before, the Haiti that has nurtured me. And also the poem which won me the Grolier Poetry Prize in 1993. I will start with Manini. Manini was queen of the coal kitchen, standing within 6 square feet of soot, in front of 4 pits glowing with embers, churning the bubbling bean sauce, beaming the yellow kernels of her smile at the chickens flapping in the loose ashes below. Strung together by the feet with sisal, their furious claws resembling the old people's toenails. She sighed as she sat on a low straw chair, the heat-lacquered columns of her black legs folded in a squat, her soiled apron caught between her knees, forming a valley just below the wrinkled mound of the belly, to sort out peas. The good, the deceased, though all grew round together in the same pod. When she took off the flowered scarf she wore, Manini's hair resembled rice paddies, with traced avenues on her scalp that glistened like the moist red earth of Kenskoff Mountain in soft fog. The remnants of frizzy white down were gathered into inch-long, upright, puffed-up braids, which, in the darkness of the windowless kitchen, seemed the luminous gathering of her ancestors' will-o'-the-wisps, filled with murmurs about the secrets of her strength, joy, and the sweetness of the food she cooked. Mm. And this one carries both the past and the journey forward. And it's called Frog. If it could be done, would you want to be made into a frog? If it meant having a thin, boned spine, gray-green, humid skin that feels the sting of any slight insect you might otherwise gobble and swallow, sit the world apart in a wide, four-legged, sweaty squat, the beating of your heart showing in your throat, and yet be able to leap a distance many times your own measure. If it meant you can enter water more vast than your body can ever swim through and, nevertheless relaxed, arms and legs stretched open like a molecule afloat, round eyes absorbing the world through greenish inner screens that draw towards and within you the soft slithering silk of the water's surface, the slosh and sway of high palm leaves, defiant birds gathered in the immense blue end, even then still be able to stare at the sun. And if it also meant you could dive deep in the far depth of the water, go down, down to where there is no bottom, none to feel or reach, down to an infinity of movement that requires no breath. If it could be done, and it meant you would, no love, would you come to be born a man? Or even woman?
My little brain is processing that very big poem.
You know, while you're processing it, I'll give you a lovely quote from William Carlos Williams. If you ask why be a poet, why poetry, and why do we turn to poetry when there is horror and disaster, what is it that poetry brings us? William Carlos Williams says, "It is difficult to get the news from poems. Yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there."
That's perfect. I want to get my news from poetry from now on. I think a lot of us have this feeling that, in a sense, we've got the news already from Haiti. We can't get any more. And so much of the news about Haiti is not what we need to know. It's about, you know, another doctor or another nurse or another body or another something, a great deal of it in the context of, gosh, aren't we doing a lot? And of course we are, and yet it's not what we want to know.
You know, you were asking me for Haitian poetry. This is a part of a poem of Georges Castras, Haitian poet. And the poem is called Blood. This is a section. "Let's go see the blood flow, darling. For once in a lifetime, it's not people's blood spilling. For once in the street, it's not animal blood flowing. Let's go see the blood flow, darling. The sun is setting."
Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell, it's a huge gift and pleasure to hear you read and to be with you here. Thank you.
It's a huge pleasure and an honor to be invited to speak with you. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy recorded this conversation with Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell in the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ben Mandelkern edited it at the Watson Institute. We continue the conversations on Haiti tomorrow with Eli Marienthal, who finds himself twinned today as a young performance poet with a Haitian boy he met at age 7. Listeners, you can link to Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell's paintings and stories. You can feedback your own experience, your own lessons from Haiti, on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.